Well, we're glad to be back. You know, it has always been difficult for me to know what is best to teach at the last service of a gospel meeting. A fellow told me years ago down in Florida, he's long since dead, but he said, let me make a suggestion. Try to talk on something that people will remember. And so I'm going to try to do that today. I've mentioned earlier in the meeting that there's something very special about the parables of Christ. The teachings of Christ are just, well, they're incredible, obviously. No wonder they referred to him as the Master. So today I want to talk a little while. I probably won't be able to mention all of them, but I want to mention some of the Beatitudes. And the reason I got interested in this was because, quite frankly, the Beatitudes were difficult for me to get hold of. As the young people sometimes say, it was hard for me to get my head wrapped around it. A lot of what it said just didn't seem to make a lot of sense. And so I decided here a while back that once and for all, I was going to try to get to the bottom of what some of those things are about. I'll begin reading in Matthew chapter 5, and I'll read through verse 12 of chapter 5. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Some of these seem just so difficult. For instance, the very first one, blessed are the poor in spirit. Why is it blessed to be poor in spirit? You'd think that he'd want it to be the other way. He'd want us to be rich in spirit. Well, he does. But there is a blessing in being poor in spirit. And this is what kind of got me interested to start with, because it seemed a little backwards to me. But when you kind of get underneath the surface, there is really some beautiful things. And so we're going to talk about a few of those with you today. Well, I'm sure we won't be able to reach them all, but we'll go as far as we can. But before we do, at this time, let us pray. The writer of Hebrews 11 and verse 6 says, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Faith, as is defined in that context, I believe, is conviction and confidence. Conviction, first of all, that God does exist, and secondly, confidence that he will do that which he has promised. One of the things that the Scriptures does tell us about God is that it is impossible for him to lie. I suppose about the only thing that it is impossible for him to do. The text now before us describes the experience of a person who turns from darkness to light, and it marks the beginning, if you will, of that life which, if consistently pursued, will ultimately lead us to a home with God. Some say that the Beatitudes is really just a study in values, and I think that's probably, for the most part, true. And they say that Jesus is really saying, if you want to be happy, if you want to be blessed, here is the standard, here is the recipe, if you will. I think most of us are aware that the term beatitude or blessed is sometimes can be translated, happy are ye. And really, I think that's also true. It may not work in every one of the cases, but I think generally speaking, that's right. Blessed is he, Jesus said. Blessed is he who are, or blessed are, the poor in spirit. Now, as I told you before prayer, that was always a little obscure for me. It just didn't somehow seem to ring true. I knew it was because Jesus said it. But I finally began by asking myself, how is a man poor physically? Well, that's easy to find out. A man is poor physically when he has no money, when he has no physical resources. So obviously, a man is poor in spirit who has no spiritual resources. Now, here's the thing. When he has no spiritual resources, he soon realizes that he doesn't. He's ready and willing to accept and listen to the Lord. He wants help. He accepts the Lord's help on the Lord's terms. And I think this is the idea behind this. This is why that it is blessed to be poor in spirit. Now, you know, worldly men will say that pride and even a bit of arrogance may be beneficial to the world. Well, I suppose in one context it may be. If you're in some business or skill, some trade, if you don't have pride in what you do, if you're not proud of the work that you can do, if you don't want to be a craftsman, it's not likely that you will ever excel and reach the top or the pinnacle of skill in your particular craft or trade. But when it, and so from that standpoint, yeah, it's good to have some pride. But from the standpoint of pride, generally speaking, the Bible says no. For instance, in Proverbs 16 and 18, Solomon said, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. I think we all understand that. A fellow who's full of pride, there's not much you can tell him. He doesn't want to listen to anything you've got to say. He thinks that you're he's far above him, you. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 6, Peter said, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. I remember when I was just a young boy, I listened to the old preachers preach, and one of the things that they often said was, the way up is down, and the way down is up. What they meant by that is, if you want the Lord to debase you, if you want him to humble you, then you put yourself up on a pedestal and you be prideful. You go around with a haughty spirit. Somehow, you're going to wind up down below. That's just all there is to it. It's either the Lord or the brethren or maybe both. But if you're going to be a prideful man and have a haughty spirit, you're not going to be accepted very well. Just isn't going to happen. I remember hearing, it was the true story, about one of our young preachers. He happens to be dead now. But he was at one of our big meetings up in the eastern part of the country, and they were going to have a big crowd that evening, and the brethren were setting out a lot of chairs. And this young man had a little bit of an attitude of, I'm kind of exalted. I know more than some of the rest of you do. And so they were setting out chairs, and he was just standing there watching. And one of the brethren said, grab a few chairs and help us put these out. Oh, no, he said, I'm a preacher. Well, the fellow looked at him and said, I don't care if you're a preacher or not. Help us put these chairs out. And, of course, you know, if you read in Bible times, some of the greatest men, such as Elijah and Isaiah and some of those men, they were working men. They got with it as far as physical labor was concerned. And so there's nothing wrong with anybody, however proud they may be, in working. So be careful not to have that prideful spirit. The prideful man cannot see his own weakness. He just can't see it. He's unable to see the good in others, and so sees no reason to draw upon them for any kind of help. Conversely, a humble man, seeing his own weakness, is therefore in a position to reach out and to get the help that he needs to fill his need. He recognizes the strength in others. I'll tell you, one of the greatest benefits to any young man or woman, whether you're interested in preaching the gospel or just being a homebody, one of the greatest strengths you will ever have is to see the strength and the wisdom found in others who are older and try to avail yourself of that. Try to learn from that. Sit down with them and talk with them. You know, this is one of the reasons that the Bible teaches us how that the older women are to teach the younger women. Now, Paul's not telling us that we want to get us a class and the older women teach the younger women. That's not the idea. What he's wanting the younger women to learn is may take years to learn, months at least. And what they're going to teach those younger women is by example, by the younger women watching them. The younger women watch them as a wife, as a mother, the way they handle their problems in the family, and they learn from that. That's the way the older women teach the younger. I'm not saying that it's wrong or bad for a young woman to go to one of the older sisters privately and say, I wish you'd explain some of these scriptures to me. I don't have any objection to that. But what Paul is talking about is younger women learning from the examples of the older women, from them living the kind of life and setting the example before others that they do. Such a man who has this kind of ability to draw upon the knowledge and the help of others, he will soon realize that he desperately needs God. He's got to have him. And so they see themselves as they really are in God's sight. That's why it is blessed to be poor in spirit. That fella is in a position to see, oh, I need help. I need the benefit of all of this. They're conscious of nothing except their need of love and forgiveness. An interesting passage is found in Isaiah 66, verses 1 and 2. Isaiah wrote in prophetic language, and he said, thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne. Now listen carefully. The heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me, and where is the place of my rest? For all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord, but to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. Any dictionary will tell you that the word contrite means a deep feeling of sorrow or remorse for having sinned or done wrong. In other words, it is a penitent spirit. Now, I want you to think about what God is saying here. He says, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Now, how big is man? Well, we kind of take pride in what we have done in the United States. We've put men on the moon. We've had any number of space missions. We've just been everywhere. We sent this one to Mars and that one to somewhere else. And yet God said, listen, the heaven is my throne. That's where I abide. And the earth is my footstool. Where's the house that you build for me? What can you do for me? Now, I'm going to tell you what, when you look at us in the proper perspective, we are, as Linwood used to say, as Ned in the first reader. We don't have a clue. We don't have any idea of how august and how awesome the God that we serve is. This God was so powerful that he spoke all of this into existence. He is so powerful that everything you see is held up there by the benefit of his Son. That's what keeps it all there. How are we going to impress him? Well, we aren't. And it's really foolish for us to think that we might. Where is the house that you build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? For all those things have mine hand made. I've already done it. I'm ahead of you. You're never going to catch me. Well, they think of nothing, really, except their need. We think of nothing, really, except our need of his love and forgiveness. I'm going to turn and read just a little bit more from Ecclesiastes chapter 7. I'll read verses 2 through 4. I love to read Solomon's writing anyway. He says, it is better, and here's another one of those things that's kind of difficult to get hold of. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. What? Why would that be? Why in the world would it be better to go to the house of mourning, a place where people are sad and mourning, perhaps at the death of a loved one? Why is it more beneficial to us as people to be among that atmosphere than it is to go to a party atmosphere where everybody's enjoying life and they're frivolous and so on? Well, here's why it is. He said, for that is the end of all men. That's the end of all men. And the living will lay it to his heart. Listen to me. When you look down at a loved one in a coffin, what you're seeing is the end of all men. And that's where we're all going. That's why it is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of mirth or feasting. The living, Solomon said, will lay that to heart. We can take a lesson from that. We realize, hey, that's where I'm going to be one of these days. What do I need to do? I better live in a covenant relationship with God, because that's where I'm going to be. And when you get there, it's too late to make any changes. So that's why that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. He said in verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. Now, those of you who know me very well know that I love to laugh, and I do a lot of it. Generally speaking, I'm a pretty positive person. And if I get down, I don't like to stay down. I like to try to get up. And my nature is to be kind of a positive person. But Solomon said, sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. What does he mean? Well, it has to be that when you're in a reflective mood, when you're a little bit sad and you're a little bit mourning, you're more likely to think of heavenly things and godly things and spiritual things. Those things become a little bit more serious and a little bit more important. In verse 4, he said, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Boy, that just brings me right back down where I need to be. And then he said in verse 4, blessed are they that mourn. Well, this kind of goes along with what Solomon said, doesn't it? You notice the relationship of this beatitude to the first one. If it's blessed to be poor in spirit, I suppose I can see why that it is blessed to be in mourning. This relationship, I think, is forcefully related to the relationship and the story, the lesson that Jesus gave us of the prodigal son. I'm not going to take the time to teach this whole parable, but in that parable, and by the way, my understanding of the prodigal son, in the context in which that is found, I believe there are three illustrations, but all part of the same parable. He starts out by talking about the man that has 100 sheep, and then about the woman that loses 10 pieces of silver, and finally he moves on, to the man that had two sons. There's a whole sermon there, and it's one of my favorites to preach, but I believe it's all part of the same parable. But you know, in this last part of the parable, this man has two sons, and the younger of the sons comes to the father, and he says, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. Very unusual request. Usually, the older brother would inherit first, and then the younger. But this younger one jumps ahead. Dad, give me what's coming to me. And when I read that and think of that, I'm always made to wonder what my dad would have said if I'd have ever gone to him and said, Dad, give me what's coming to me. Whatever I would have gotten, I doubt there would have been much money involved. Give me what's coming to me. Now, this father in this parable is analogous, if you will, to the Father in heaven. And so this father divides his living among his two sons. And Jesus says, not many days hence, the younger took his leave and went into a far country and wasted his substance in riotous living. By the way, at the end of that story, it tells about the older brother coming in, and he's so ungracious and he's so angry that this younger brother has come back, and he tells his father, this son of yours, not his brother, but this son of yours has gone off and wasted your money with harlots. Now, he didn't know that. He didn't know that. And the old preachers used to say that probably the reason he said that is because that's what he would have done in the same situation. But the truth of it is, riotous living is the kind of living that may very well have included that sort of flagrant behavior. It fits. He may very well have been guilty of that. We don't know. It doesn't say. But at any rate, at some point, he has gone through his dad's money, and he is as broke as he can be. He joins himself to the citizen of the country, obviously a Gentile, who sends him into his fields to feed swine, pigs, a very, very bad, nasty job for a Jew. They, the pigs were unclean. Jews weren't supposed to do that. They were above that. They couldn't eat pork anyway. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. But this young man, this young Jewish man, is down there feeding the hogs. And he is willing, if he could have, he is willing to eat with the hogs. Never been that hungry myself. I used to feed hogs, but I never wanted to eat what they did. And finally, Jesus said he came to himself. And by the way, let me mention this. He is down there so destitute, willing to eat with the pigs. And Jesus says, and this escapes you if you're not careful, and no man gave unto him. You know, that's still true. There's an old blues song that says, nobody wants you when you're down and out. That's right. If you're down and you don't have anything and you're worthless and you're just a lazy slug, there's nobody wants to fool with you. You're not going to make any points with anybody. And this young man doesn't make any points with the Lord. Nobody gave anything to him. And so he comes to himself and he says, I know what I'll do. My father has servants. They're only servants, but they're better off than I am. They have bread and to spare. And so I'm going to go home. And he says, I'm going to tell my father, I've sinned against heaven and before thee, and I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Just make me as one of the hired servants. And so he starts home. And I'm skipping a lot here. I just need to get to the point. As he comes home, Jesus switches the scene, as it were. And it almost looks like that his father, the old man, is out working along the front of the road there, waiting for that boy to come back. I think he expected him to come back. He's out there, and one of these days, he sees this fella coming down the road. Oh, he doesn't look like he did when he left, but he recognizes him. It's his boy. He left with shoes on his feet, and a robe on his back, and a ring on his finger. But he ain't got any of that now. He's undoubtedly lost them in various gambling games, or maybe had them stolen, or maybe he sold them. But he's pretty destitute now. Undoubtedly dirty, scraggly. But the old man drops everything and runs out there and fell on his neck and kissed him. And oh, a great reunion took place. Now here's the moral of the story, and here's the reason that I told it today in this particular setting. Jesus said, blessed are they that mourn. Why do you think that young man came home? He came home because he became so destitute, he finally realized, boy, I have made a bad mistake. I am down here in sin. I'm down here with Gentiles. I'm down here away from home in a land of sin and undoubtedly had been living a sinful life. I'm going home. Jesus said he came to himself. You know, a lot of times people will say, oh, thank the Lord. This shows the grace of God and how wonderful it is and how that God's grace will take care of you even in the depth of sin. It does no such thing. This father's grace didn't mean a thing to this young man until he came to himself and came home. Now, if you're out in the world of sin this day and looking and wondering where the grace of God is, the grace of God has already done for you all that it's going to do. It has provided Jesus Christ. It has provided the church. It has provided an attitude and an avenue whereby you can be free and forgiven of your sins. That's what the grace of God will do for you. And when you come home, then that grace of God will allow you to be forgiven. And you can pick up and take off again. Now, it's interesting to me, and I don't want to dwell on this because I need to get on, but it's interesting to me that this father said, bring a robe and put on him, and a ring and put on him, and shoes and put on his feet. But the truth of it is, he didn't say bring a robe, did he? If you're looking at the passage, and you can read this in Luke, the 15th chapter, I believe it is. If you're looking at that passage, you'll see there that what this father said is bring the best robe and put on him. Over yonder in Revelation, you can read about a heavenly scene that John saw. He saw a scene over there where all of those people were there saved. And John said, these are they that have come through. They've come through great tribulation. And they have made their robes white in the blood of the Lamb. I submit to you today, that's the best robe. That's the best robe. And when you come back, when you come to yourself and you come back, you know what? The only robe that the Lord is willing for you to have is the best one. And that means forgiveness. That's what this is all about. That's what that best robe stands for. Your Father in heaven is not willing for you to have anything other than the best one. Well, blessed are they that mourn. And this young man finally got in such a state that really he was forced to see himself in the proper perspective. He realized that he was lost and he came back. Now, look again in verse 5. There Jesus said, blessed are the meek. The relation of this one with the very first two Beatitudes again could be illustrated by the prodigal son, but since I've just told it, try to remember that. Blessed are the meek. It can be illustrated again by the case of the prodigal son, a case of misery, finally a recognition of the sin, a confession of that sin, and a return to the truth, along with a feeling of unworthiness. The basic idea seems to be one of gentleness in the sense that Jesus was gentle. You know, over yonder in Isaiah, the 42nd chapter, Isaiah spoke of Jesus in prophetic terms and said that when he came, and this is hundreds of years before he came to the world, Isaiah said, when he comes, he will not break the bruised reed. Ever thought about that? Along the rivers and the creeks in that part of the world, as well as our part of the world, many times you'll see these reeds growing. They'll be up pretty good size. They're not even as big as your little finger. And they're really pretty strong and pretty sturdy, and the wind blows and they just, you know, they stand up to all of that. But if you take a little stick and just hit one of those on the side, it'll make a little dark spot. And then the first time the wind blows, it'll just fall over. That's what a bruised reed is. And Jesus is so gentle, Isaiah said, that when he comes, he will not cause the bruised reed to break. Now let me illustrate this. In the 8th chapter of John is found probably my favorite case ever in the life of Christ. I don't know of anything that illustrates his gentle nature any better than this one. Jesus had gone into a position of teaching. And while he's teaching, some of the big shots of the day, Pharisees, chief priests, whatever, they brought a woman to him. You talk about a set-up deal. They brought a woman to him that had been taken in adultery. In fact, they told Jesus, she's been taken in the very act. Now they gave themselves away there pretty badly. And they said, now the law says she ought to be stoned, but what sayest thou? Well, the law did say that. In Leviticus, the 20th chapter, it said that the punishment for adultery, you know, that was a capital offense. If it could be proven, they were stoned to death. Jesus just stooped down and began to write in the dust. And they thought, oh, we got him. And so they pressed him. And he looked up and he said, he that is without sin, let him cast the first stone. He had the law on his side there too, because Deuteronomy 17 said that when you had a case like this and a person was to be stoned, those who were witnesses must be willing to cast the first. You had to have at least two, but they had to be willing to cast the first stones. You couldn't just make up a story and get somebody killed. You better be the right thing, and you better be willing to help in the killing of these people. Well, Jesus just went back to writing in the dust. I don't know what he was writing. Bible doesn't say. And they all began to just kind of slide out of there. Now, let me go back to what I said earlier when I said they gave themselves away. What do you know when you read that this woman was taken in adultery in the very act? You know, and I do too, that they not only caught that woman, but they caught a man, didn't they? Wonder where he was. Could he have been one of those that was in the crowd? Or could he have just been one of their friends? Could that be the reason that these fellows began to slide out? I wouldn't doubt it. The Bible does indicate that they left because of their own conscience. And so finally Jesus looked up. And he said to this woman, and let me remind you, that under the old law, when you had a charge brought like the charge of adultery, when the charge was made, it had to be in the mouth of two or three witnesses. But if the witnesses recanted, if the witnesses were not forthcoming, the whole thing was just thrown out. That was the law. So Jesus looks up at this woman and he said, "Woman, where are those thine accusers? Doth no man accuse thee?" And she said, "No man, Lord." And he said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go thy way and sin no more." Now you see how he led this woman back to the path of right and duty. You see how he caused others who were there to see what was right. But look how gentle he was. He didn't jump on her with hobnail boots. He didn't just rough her. He applied the law. He showed how the law could be applied. And when it didn't work for her, he turned her loose. Because that's what the law said would be happen. That's what the law said would happen. So, blessed are they who are meek. You know, the term meek is an interesting word. Jesus was meek. And meek literally means somebody that has the power to retaliate but chooses not to. Jesus could have retaliated when they arrested him and crucified him. He could have called all those angels the Bible talks about and just tore up the world, but he didn't. He meekly went to the cross, just like Isaiah said he would, that he would be led as a sheep to the slaughter and like a lamb dumb before his shearers, so openeth he not his mouth, and etc., etc., etc. Jesus fulfilled that prophetic language. Blessed are the meek. And so blessed are we when we have the power, when we have the ability to retaliate, but we choose not. We choose not. The church will be better off, our families will be better off, and we'll be better off. I'm almost out of time, but I want to mention real quick one more. In verse 6, Jesus said, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness." Well, this is a little easier to get hold of because I can see, all of us can see, how that would really have something, you know, that would mean so much to all of us. A man who is really thirsty and hungry can think of nothing else. That's all he's interested in. But you know, so many times the people of the world come and they hear maybe a great sermon, but they're not interested. And so it does them absolutely no good. I remember, years ago, I was pretty young at the time, just not hadn't been married too long. Brother Clovis Cook came to California and held a meeting in California. And my brother and I and Clovis went up in the mountains one day and went trout fishing. And we walked about 2 miles from the road down to this stream that was down in a canyon. And there was probably, 3 or 4 feet of snow on the ground. It was hip deep. But it was real cold the night before, cold that morning. And we walked in that morning on a hard crust. No problem. And plus, we was going downhill. That helped. But when we came out that afternoon, sun had come out, warmed things up. That icy crust had melted, and every step we took, we sunk to our hips. We had 2 miles to do going uphill like that. We came on 3 men that were pulling a canoe with a rope. They were pulling it out of there. Good-looking canoe, looked like nearly new. Expensive. When we got there, they said, "Y'all want a canoe?" We said, "No, not if we got to get it out of here." We just left it with them. We'd take 3 or 4 steps and just fall out on the snow, just exhausted. And we hadn't gone far. We hadn't gone far, and I'm betraying the fact that we might not have been in the best of physical condition, but we hadn't gone far before those leg cramps began to come on us. And we were just really suffering. We were hours getting out of there. And when we started up that last hill, Clovis said, "Boys, I haven't said anything about it, but," he said, I've brought 3 Baby Ruth candy bars today. And they're up there in the car waiting for us. Giant economy size. And when we get there, we can all have one of those." Well, you talk about 3 fellas that made the best time they could. We were hungry. We were just worn out. We wanted something to replenish some energy in our bodies. We were just done in. And so we just fought to the top of that hill and fell into that car and jumped on those candy bars with all they were worth. And I made the statement, "If you'll stop at the first store, I'll buy us a case of it." It was just that good. It was wonderful. I'd never eaten anything that tasted so good. Now, if you have a fella who has that kind of a hunger and that kind of a desire for God's truth, do you think you can stop him from learning what's right? No, sir. He won't have anything but the truth, and he's going to stay with it until he gets it. No wonder Jesus said, "Blessed or happy are they who do hunger and thirst after righteousness." He'll get it, and he'll be saved because he won't have anything else. Oh, there's so many others. I've only gone over 4 of these Beatitudes, but I think you can see that the Beatitudes are really great. Sometimes I teach half of these on Sunday morning and half on Sunday night, and tonight you just got half. Maybe the next time we'll touch on the others. But, you know, these are really great lessons. And when you study what Jesus said, if you don't get it, as a lot of times we don't, if you don't get it, just keep thinking about it. Just keep trying to figure out, now, why would Jesus say what he did? What did he mean by that? Eventually, when you see it, it's just like a key that unlocks the knowledge of all the rest of it, and it'll all just open up for you. The Beatitudes are wonderful. And it was years and years that I just didn't pay much attention to it because I couldn't figure it out, really. It just kind of seemed like an empty way for me. Well, I wonder if there are those here who have never obeyed the gospel. The Bible teaches that we have to hear it, that we have to believe it, we have to repent of our sins and confess our faith and be baptized in water for the remission of sins. That puts you into the church, puts you into Christ. And the body of Christ and the body in the church of the church is the same thing. If you're in one, you're in the other. And that's where we contact God, who reconciles us to himself. Maybe you're here today and you realize that you're kind of lost and undone. And you realize, like the prodigal son, that it's time for you to come to yourself and make your way back to the Father. The Father is anxious to receive you. Know that. While we stand and while we sing.